The few powers the people had consented to give it was for Madison so significant that he vetoed his own administration's chief domestic measure of his last 2 years as president. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Setting the stage, our next speaker, Professor Gordon Lloyd, is a professor of political economy at Pepperdine University School of Public Policy. Has a PhD from Claremont Graduate School. He's a co-author of three books, author of an important book on the New Deal, and he is going to focus in on the document itself, the Constitution, and how it relates to federalism. Gordon?
Several years ago, I was asked to give a talk at a British university. Somebody had gone on leave, and they wanted an American to talk about colonialism. And I figured, why study the colonial past? That was the talk. And the talk was linked to a video coverage, which the students had already seen, and readings, which the students had already read. The problem is that what I was prepared to say didn't match what the students had seen and read. And what they saw and read for the colonial past was the Salem witch trials. And the ground for that was that if you want to understand America today, you have to understand witch hunting. There were three American students in the class, and I said, let us try to understand whether there's an enduring feature to America other than this strange witch hunting. And I said, if you were to choose a document or documents from the 20th century, what might they be? Say, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream, Roosevelt's Commonwealth Club. You go to the 19th century, you get the Gettysburg Address. You go to the 18th century, have the Constitution. What if you were to go to the 17th century, to the colonial past? What would you extract from that? And the three Americans got it, the Mayflower Compact, the writing down of constitutions in the various colonial assemblies and legislatures. In other words, very, very few countries that I know of study their colonial past. They want to flee it. Or they have a revisionist understanding of their colonial past. We have a decent colonial past in the sense that there is something well worthwhile carrying forward. And I think that is, we write things down, we have a certain understanding of constitutionalism. And this raises an interesting question. Federalism is very much part of writing things down. We have the Articles of Confederation, we have Confederation, the Southern Confederation, and of course we have the U.S. Constitution, which, as Kevin has said, is a sort of a balance between old-fashioned federalism and new federalism, but it's written down. And so one question that we need to deal with is, why do we feel safer or freer when we write things down? Because when we write things down, it has to be interpreted. And how do you interpret silence? So we've both got a plus and a minus, or we've got a paradox. We feel better by writing things down. By writing things down, we have to have an interpreter. And how do you interpret that through time? I, therefore, want to propose that Bill's title worries me a bit, because I've just given that little story about war. What I would suggest is that federalism tames spirituality. It tames the witch hunting. It tames the utopian visions. It tames that. In other words, federalism is a conservative instrument. It reacts, particularly reacts to wild spiritual things. In the 20th century, it was reacting to prohibition. By the way, if you want to see federalism alive and well, look at the liquor laws on a Sunday. You can have incredible variety from one state to another state. That we managed to tolerate this diversity. And it's absolutely amazing to see, and nobody seems to get upset at this huge variety of liquor laws. But what I'm getting at is that the progressives are really prohibitionists. And the prohibitionists want to purify us. And they want to get rid of sort of the impurities. And once that gets into your politics, then how are you going to moderate that? And the answer is federalism comes in as a moderating device. Now, so it takes quite some time to get this utopian spiritual vision in place because federalism will slow it down here and slow it down there. But to answer Dan's point about he's sort of a bit pessimistic about the fact it will take 10 years to get rid of this deficit problem and debt problem. And the answer is, yeah, it may even take 25 years because one of the beauties of federalism is it may take long to get something into practice, but the very fact that it's in is going to take a long time to get it out of practice. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that federalism is a prudential instrument. Therefore, it slows things down getting in, but it will also slow things down getting out. And we have to recognize that. In terms of the Constitution itself, I'm not going to go through the anti-federalist stuff. You guys know all of that, but I do want to mention two points. One point is that we understand this new federalism, which is clearly is new from different from the Articles. I think if we make a distinction between structure and powers, the structural question is where do the states fit in to the system? We know where they fit into the Articles. And as Kevin has gone through, there's a question about where they fit in and how they fit in. Now, I think our conservatives friends have spent too much time dealing with states fitting in terms of their electoral function. Namely, in the original Constitution, the state legislatures elected the senators from the state. Thus, there is a considerable amount of pessimism among conservatives with regard to the passage of the 17th Amendment. That seems to be some kind of huge blow to federalism, or it may have even killed federalism, the 17th Amendment. Well, if you look at the Federalist, anti-Federalist argument, that was perhaps a necessary condition, but it was not the sufficient or the critical point. And moreover, it's been with us now for 100 years, which is now part of our constitutional morality. The interesting thing about the progressives and the New Deal, unlike the New Deal, the progressives have left us 4 amendments. The Federalist, anti-Federalist debate left us 10 amendments. The Civil War debate left us 3 amendments. The New Deal left us no amendments except limiting the presidency to 2 terms. The New Deal is all about interpretation. And that is the danger because it can sap the what I will call the constitutional morality of the people. That is long time enduring willing support of the arrangement that the federal arrangement. So it saps. Whereas at least the progressives with their amendment, they did it. And interestingly, I've always found this fascinating. It took two-thirds of the Senate elected by the state legislatures, three-quarters of the state legislatures, to agree that the state legislatures should elect U.S. Senate. That might be suicide. But it's something. But what it suggests to me is that there's something more important going on the 17th Amendment. We shouldn't just get pessimistic, because there's something other than electing the U.S. Senate which is important to federalism. And the answer is equality. Equality of the states in the Senate. The equality of the states in the electoral process, true, for the president. The equality of the states and the dominance of the states in the amending of the Constitution. So it's the equality of the states, and that has not gone. And so when we talk about the wound or the death or the good old days, I would argue that federalism is alive. Constitutionalism is alive in the sense that we have a corpus. And I would say federalism should be linked to separation of powers and checks and balances. That the three go together, they're cousins. And so they go together. And what do? If working properly, they slow things down and they create what Madison called the deliberate sense of the community. And that deliberate sense of the community is what we need for free government. Now, just to make a sort of an exaggerated point, the legacy of the anti-federalists, I think, is to remind us that our enterprise is free government and not good government. Now, it's all right to get good government, but it must be free. And I think there is a tendency in the Federalist Party, and Hamilton in particular, to want good government. And you tell me how free it must be. And once I think we understand the distinction between free government and good government, I think we are on the road to understanding the role of federalism. Federalism and good government do not go together. Federalism and free government do go together, because there's a prudential dimension. I mean, you don't hear, or you ought not to hear, somebody going down the street saying, what do you want, federalism? When do you want it? Now and again, here and there. It's prudential. And there's nothing wrong, it seems to me, in slowing things down. Federalism is a conservative principle. It is a response, particularly to, shall we say, utopian action, national democracy, the whole idea, it seems to me, that federalism is valuable and it slows things down. It's not going to be radical solutions, but it'll slow things down. When you hear Roosevelt says, I look out there and I see one-third ill-clad, ill-housed, one-third ill-fed, and the idea is, everyone must be. Well, you ain't going to get there, because inherently it's very difficult to do, if not impossible, but you got to go through a lot of loops and hoops to get there. So there's a chance that the next time around it can be stopped or slowed down. There's nothing wrong in slowing things down. Now we're facing, I look out there and I see one dumb child left behind. That can never happen. I look out there and I see one obese person left behind. That can't happen. Somehow the role of government is to transform us all. And what we need is some feature to slow things down. Final point. The case for federalism is actually the case for localism and the case for local variety. And the states and provide this constitutional protection for that variety. So one question we have to keep asking ourselves is, how much variety can we tolerate? As far as the progressives are concerned, as little as possible in terms of different conduct in different states. Are you telling me that that a woman could, before the 19th Amendment, a woman could vote in one state but not another state? Yeah, I'm telling you that. Are you saying that because of the accident of residence, the right to vote is determined? I said, yes. How undemocratic? How federal? Can you see the same thing? We can go all the way through. So how much variety are we willing to accept? For example, Jefferson says, I'm paraphrasing, what does it matter to me if my neighbor believes in one God or 10 gods? That means religious variety, religious tolerance. The role of the government is not to tell me or tell others in terms of the role to rule in the religious realm. Fine. Federalism helps. But what if we were to change the subject and say, what if my neighbor has one abortion or 10 abortions? I don't care. What if we were to change it and say, what if my neighbor has one slave or 10 slaves? What does it matter to me? Or what if my neighbor smokes one cigarette or 10 cigarettes? Or drinks one soda or 10 sodas? In other words, I think federalism slows that kind of wild spirituality down. And it is no problem, it seems to me, to be attached to that, and that is very much alive in constitutional morality, and I would love us to get back to that kind of corpus. It means rejuvenating the Congress. It means listening to the anti-federalist warning. The warning is that the Constitution, as Kevin has shown us, it can go centrifugal or it can go centripetal. And that means balance. That means statesmanship. It means an understanding, civic education of this delicate feature called federalism. And it means that we've got to be understand that federalism and the Congress are vital parts of what I would call constitutional morality. Unfortunately, 10% of the population are attached to Congress, and people just don't turn out anymore or much more for state and local elections and get involved. It's the presidency that becomes the central attention, and the language changes. We now, since Roosevelt, talk about midterms, an off year. I know, what's off about a congressional election? What's mid about a congressional election? Why doesn't Congress, for example, play its role? It controls virtually all the powers of the judiciary, and it is AWOL. It controls considerable amount with regard to the presidency, and it doesn't. Separation of powers, federalism, I'm arguing, is the constitutional morality bequeathed to us by the framers, and it is not dead. It may be wounded, but if we attach ourselves to it, there is no need for us to be pessimistic. I mean, I'm an immigrant. I don't want to go down to with friends down to Ellis Island or the Statue of Liberty. Say, why don't we all go down the Statue of Liberty, all of us, and then stand out there and say to the immigrants, stay home. We don't want you because for your own good. Because America is going down. If conservatism is to conserve pessimism, we're in trouble. Conservatism must be optimistic. Federalism is an optimistic. It is, as Tocqueville would call it, a sublime. It's not a sublime doctrine. And it works. And federalism, rightly understood, means an attachment to the Constitution and just keep your feet on the ground and keep putting one foot in front of the other. And that there's nothing miserable about that. Thank you.